Spencer.
And this is Sal.
And welcome to Rift Radio. Today we're speaking with Budur Hassan, a Palestinian journalist and researcher at the Jerusalem Center for Legal Aid and Human Rights. Thanks for joining us, Budur. So today we'd like to talk a bit about how the framing and lexicon of the Israeli government is adopted in media coverage, influencing the way we think about the occupation of Palestine. So I'd like to start with a recent example that shows how this phenomenon isn't just restricted to mainstream corporate media. During your recent interview on Democracy Now!, you corrected the term Israeli Arab. Can you tell us a bit about where that term comes from, what it means, and how the Israeli government uses it to try to break solidarity between Palestinians by stratifying them with different degrees of rights?
Yes, so it's obviously not exclusive to Democracy Now! This is a term that has dominated much of the media coverage regarding Palestine. And unfortunately, it's not even limited to Western media coverage on Palestine. We've been seeing also that some Arab media is adopting it as well. Obviously, Palestine, one of the main claims of the Zionist movement was that Palestinians as a national group do not exist. So there are Arabs, and Palestinians are part of the larger Arab people. Obviously, many Palestinians don't deny that. Although when we're talking about Palestinians, there are Palestinians who are Armenian, for example, or who, although the vast, the overwhelming part, majority of Palestinians do identify as Arabs. But our problem with us being reduced to Israeli Arabs, that's, as I said, since 1948, the very small minority of Palestinians who stayed on their land on what became known as Israel, what is for us is Palestine, were an Israeli citizenship were imposed on them, and they lived under military rule from 1948 and to 1966. And during that period, Israel worked tirelessly to erase their identity, to take advantage of the fact that they were under military rule, and they were absolutely and totally isolated from their Palestinian extension and Palestinian ties, and also from their Arab extension. And these attempts took several forms. One of them was linguistic, symbolic, and physical as well, physical erasure and separation. And then the imposition of the terms Israeli Arab came to say that these people exist only as Israelis. They don't have, they're not a national group. There's just one minority. And in this minority, there are Christian Arabs, there are Muslim Arabs, there are Druze Arabs. So even this group that Israel termed Israeli Arabs was then stratified and divided on religious lines to further break the commonality and the identity of the Palestinian people, and then deny that Palestinian. We all know these ridiculous, almost kind of jokes that were invented by some Israeli politicians to deny that Palestinians exist. From Golda Meir's claim that Palestine, that the letter P doesn't exist in Arabic, so alphabet. So this is a proof that there is no such thing as Palestine, and etc. That's even ridiculous. And since then, it continues to be used in all Israeli media. And the Palestinian society that lives in the territories occupied in 1948 is referred to as the Arab sector, not even society. And it has only in recent years, it has become to be challenged internationally. Although Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship have always challenged it. We've always said that our existence predates the existence of the State of Israel. Our great-grandparents lived here before the Zionist movement even came. So it's ridiculous to refer us to something that we predate as a group. And to also insist that Palestinian nationalism also existed before 1948.
Given the history of Israel's relationships with America and the UK, I wanted to ask, do you feel that Western media puts a disproportionate focus on Palestinian stories, and particularly stories that don't really involve resisting occupation or combating any kind of like mainstream narrative of some sort of peaceful multicultural settler society? And has that, do you also think that that has changed in recent coverage of the events?
Yeah, I think what you meant is that Palestine is usually covered when it comes to political tensions, when it comes to escalation, to the extent that some people don't even recognize that we have daily life of our own, that we do other stuff other than just fighting Israeli occupation. We do art, we do music, we do sports, we do life, basically. Yes, which is true, and we've always done that. Now, and obviously it's very important to focus on all the beautiful, ugly, normal, real things that Palestinians do. We're complicated as individuals. We have our individuality, and we want our individuality to be stressed. When a Palestinian author writes something, I don't want her piece of art to be referred to solely in the context of Israeli occupation, but as an aesthetic piece of work. Same applies to music. If a Palestinian artist does some music, I don't want in every piece about Palestinian music to have a political connotation, as if we can't create or produce outside of the parameters of these. And this is definitely a problem, especially for those who obviously want to resist the occupation, but want the aesthetic value of their production to be recognized. They want the complexity of their lives as individuals, in their happiness, in their sadness, in their grief, to be recognized. And I think, yes, this is something that's also, it's not exclusive again to Palestinians. I feel like also when we there's it's, I can also borrow from the experiences of other minorities that are typically excluded and typically downtrodden. Like it's as if we remember last year there was all this attention suddenly given to Black art and Black literature and Black aesthetic value in the United States, but solely in the context of police shooting and police brutality and anti-racism, even though these people have for generations produced stuff and music outside, not only within that context. And they don't just want their work is not just anti, they don't want their work to be solely reduced to being taught in anti-racist workshops and then forgotten, and then to have to explain and to have to kind of represent. And this is obviously problematic because as a Palestinian, when I work outside politics, I want the quality or lack thereof, if it's not good, of my work to be treated individually, and not to have to always represent a people. I understand the complexity of doing that, especially when you are part of an oppressed people, a people that has always been denied the right to talk, to the right, silenced even. So this is problematic. But I believe that this is an opportunity. Now that people are paying more attention to Palestinian stories, that doesn't stop here, that we acknowledge that these the same people who can do all these beautiful things while resisting Israeli occupation, they also will continue to live past that. And obviously, we do work in a context of colonialism and the context of military occupation and oppression. Which affects every single aspect of our lives, whether we like it or not. But despite that, we also try to have a life that's obviously shaped by our experience as Palestinians, but that's not dictated by that.
Thanks. So, next question I had is we hear in media a lot about Hamas use of indiscriminate weaponry, which can hit civilians as they don't have the sophisticated US-made targeting technology available to the Israeli military. Yet despite targeting technology, the IDF has bombed civilian homes, hospitals, schools, media organizations, humanitarian relief centers. Can you talk about the false sense of symmetrical warfare conveyed in media and the absence of scrutiny surrounding the IDF's seemingly discriminate choice to hit civilian targets?
First of all, we argue and reality shows that Israel doesn't simply disproportionately or indiscriminately hit civilians in Gaza, that it intentionally targets civilians. And many of the claims that were used to justify the targeting of high-rise buildings in Gaza specifically said that it was also used to lower the morale of the entire population and to force the population to pressure Hamas into stopping the fighting and also to flex its muscles. Even though there is absolutely no military necessity. So it's not just disproportionate attack, it's deliberate targeting of civilians in Gaza and civilian infrastructure. As for symmetry, I mean, and Israel has been targeting and deliberately targeting Palestinians, starting from the Zionist militias that invaded Palestine under the protection of British colonial powers. And this has been happening since then, after the establishment of Israel, long before anything like Hamas even existed, right? So Hamas didn't even exist for decades. And during those 4 decades, Israel committed as a state, after it became a state, committed numerous massacres against Palestinian civilians on both sides of the Green Line. Now, when it comes to symmetry, I mean, that is not just reflected in numbers. It's reflected in power, that reflected when we're talking about one of the very strongest armies in the world that has the unconditional military support of not just the United States, it's very important to clarify, but also the European Union, that continuously refused to even to heed to any of our calls to stop arming Israel and to impose an arms embargo in Israel. And on the other side, you have resistance groups who are many of which are using homemade weapons in order to resist the forces that continues to occupy the Palestinian lands, continues to strip Palestinians of their right to return. So that's the context without which you can't understand that resistance. Now, obviously, even among Palestinians, there are discussion of strategic or tactical discussion of how to resist, how to imply what strategies or what tactics to apply. But yeah, I, as many Palestinians do, explicitly refuse any attempts to equate a state army, one of the strongest, most powerful armies in the world, an army that was founded on the deliberate killing of Palestinians and their ethnic cleansing, with resistance groups that are using whatever meager means they have in order to resist their occupier and the force that has blockaded them since 2007.
So along those same lines, we're often told that Palestinian civilians are given notice of incoming missile strikes. How is this notice administered? How can it reach Gazans during periods with no electricity? And how do we square the claims of ample warning with the high civilian death tolls?
First of all, this notice is one of the inventions of the latest Israeli military campaign. And first, many of these notices are not even meant to notify people as much as to intimidate and scare and terrorize them. So it also was one of the ways in which Israel tries to break the spirit of people by notifying them that, yeah, the house that you spend your entire life building will be destroyed and you can do nothing about it. So secondly, there are many cases where these notifications were sent and Palestinians simply couldn't leave because Israel had already bombed the roads that Palestinians use in order to leave. So they basically can't leave despite the notification. So it's even useless. Thirdly, there are the so-called warning missiles that Israel had sent as notifications. First, these warning missiles can kill. There are numerous examples of Palestinians who were killed by the firing of these missiles. These are not benign missiles that just sound. They can kill, and they have killed. And also their firing is also a means of intimidation. So these notification. And obviously, some can claim that Israel uses them just to absolve itself from responsibility under international law by saying that we have sent warning, we have sent ample warning before hitting the target. Not to mention that the very hitting of this target is illegitimate, because we're not talking about military targets, we're talking about civilian targets. So not even dual, in many, most of these occasions, not even dual use target. It's simply entirely civilian buildings. Obviously, Israel can invent claims to say that there is Palestinian media affiliated with Hamas that working there, but then this will turn any building that houses Israeli media into a legitimate target. Let's not forget that Israeli army infrastructure and Israeli military infrastructure, including the Israeli Ministry of Defense, including Israeli Army Radio, are all located in so-called civilian infrastructure and in some of the most overcrowded areas in Tel Aviv. If you want to claim that Palestinian houses or Palestinian buildings are legitimate targets because they house the Palestinian ministries affiliated with Hamas or Palestinian media, then you have to apply the same, which doesn't happen, obviously. The media doesn't apply this record. So all this comes to show that every single claim by Israel that Hamas uses Palestinians as human shields, and obviously we've seen how the Israeli army is using fabricated pictures, including pictures of missiles used by Israel during its own trainings, to claim that Hamas has put these missiles and has been firing missiles from buildings as a way to justify its attacks on Palestinian infrastructure in Gaza. So all of these, the claims of warning strikes, which kill, as we said, they're not benign. The claim of that we're notifying, so we're absolved under international law, which again is not true. And the fact that Palestinians use them, Hamas uses Palestinians as human shields, all of these are easily fabricated. It's just a shame that the same claims can be repeated again and again and again and be believed again and again and again.
It's like you said, they have the backing of large colonial apparatuses. I wanted to ask you, in addition to Hamas versus Israel, you know, Hamas being a military making homemade weapons, and not even a military, but an just a loose organization. What systems, if any, do Palestinians have to defend themselves? You know, is there any way that they can go through the courts to prevent evictions or anything like that? Is there anything that Palestinians can do to mitigate any of the cruelty that they face?
Yeah, obviously Hamas is a very well-organized resistance group that has built its infrastructure. So, I mean, and the armed Palestinian in Gaza in particular is very well-organized. They have a joint channel where they organize their activity, their resistance activity, but still, again, you can't compare it with a state like Israel or even begin to equate it. As for other strategies that Palestinians can use, I mean, since our resistance has started against British colonialism and later to Israel, we've always used so many methods to resist. From strike, the biggest strike in our history is this 1936 general strike against British colonialism, to demonstrations, to worker struggles, to during the first intifada in the 1980s, again, civil disobedience, strikes, demonstration, throwing rocks, combination of armed and popular resistance, and so many others. Again, in second intifada, combination of armed and popular resistance, weekly protests. All of these have been among the main tactics that Palestinians have used in order to resist Israeli oppression, Israeli occupation. As for going to courts, it's not as a strategy of resistance, because we realize that Israeli courts, the Israeli legal system, is part and parcel of the Israeli colonial system. And we don't even believe for a second that these courts will give us justice. I mean, the Palestinian news courts tactically, and even among Palestinians, there are long discussions on the futility or the use of going to Israeli courts on certain occasions when it comes to resisting forcible evictions or home demolitions. The main reason why we do go to courts, not because we believe that we're gonna achieve justice through Israeli courts, but because we think that this is an opportunity to delay evictions, organize ourselves, and manage to mobilize more support for our cause, and even like sometimes achieve small temporary victories, use some of the loopholes that exist that can exist in any legal system in order to achieve small victories. That's what we use the court for, not as a strategy of liberation. We know our liberation is not going to come in Israeli courts, but we use it tactically as one of the various and manifold tactics that we have always used in order to resist and to affirm our existence here. Because we don't have other choices. We can't simply say that we won't go. I mean, Israel can evict, displace us using its own laws. It applies its own laws to us, leaving us with no choice but to go to these courts. And we will have to do that on many occasions. This is how we use courts, especially when it comes to battling forcible evictions. And obviously there is the possibility of using international law, as I said, after exhausting all local all remedies that the Israeli courts can give us, there is a possibility of approaching international law. There is the investigation that the ICC has agreed to open into Israeli war crimes. Many of us don't really trust this option. And have our suspicions, but we know that this is an additional way probably to pressure Israel. We have our insistence on calling people to boycott Israel culturally, militarily, academically, and to support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel, in order to hold it accountable, to call countries that support our cause to use the universal jurisdiction principle in order to hold Israeli war criminals accountable, to prevent them from traveling freely, and to use their responsibilities as third states in order to put pressure on Israeli war criminals and to treat Israel as a pariah state, and to stop treating it as a legitimate state. This is also one of the things that we can do in addition to supporting us and mobilizing for the Palestinian cause in the streets.
So the latest news is that a ceasefire has been brokered, yet the same day came reports of another raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque with rubber-coated bullets and tear gas. What's taking place on the ground right now in Jerusalem?
First, let's start with the very basic fact that yes, ceasefire was approved. What was Israel declared a unilateral ceasefire, but that Gaza is still under blockade, under an inhuman and immoral blockade that's going for almost 15 years now. And this is an unsustainable situation, and it has put Gaza on the brink of catastrophe. Also, let's not forget that Israeli attacks, although they failed to defeat Gaza militarily, that they failed to defeat the resistance militarily, it has caused mass destruction. It has destroyed libraries, buildings, the economic sector in Gaza, and now a huge work of reconstruction will have to start. And many people will not only have to start from scratch, will have to start from under the rubble, from before, not even from zero, because they have nothing. They have lost their life savings due to this war. Not to mention all those who are now internally displaced because of the war. Those who, after having to flee their homes, their destroyed homes, are now in schools. The kids who can't go to schools either because they were martyred by Israel, or because their schools now were destroyed or partially destroyed, or because their schools served as shelters for the internally displaced. So this is the reality in Gaza, and this is why it's prohibited to turn away and not to think about Gaza, and it's prohibited to allow other powerful states to use the reconstruction in Gaza as a way to defeat the Palestinian people and to gain more wealth and to accumulate more wealth and just use it as a way to pressure Gaza and to put pressure on Palestinian civilians in Gaza. This is very important. As for Jerusalem, yes, I mean, after ceasefire, there were confrontations between Israeli police who supported settlers who stormed into Al-Aqsa Mosque for the first time in 3 weeks. Israeli settlers stormed into Al-Aqsa Mosque, supported by the Israeli army, the Israeli police, sorry. And the Israeli police detained a Palestinian photographer, attacked some Palestinian worshippers. The neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, which was one of the sparks of the current uprising, is also under siege for the past 2 weeks. Israeli police is closing all the entrances to the neighborhood, preventing Palestinians who don't live in the neighborhood from entering, while obviously allowing settlers, whoever they are, to enter. So the closure against Sheikh Jarrah with concrete blocks, cement blocks, is continuing. The strategy or the tactic of closure has long been used by Israel in Jerusalem as a tactic of collective punishment, especially in a neighborhood called Isawiyyeh, which during the past 10 years has been subjected to numerous raids and numerous closures. And we've seen this in Sheikh Jarrah, and Israel is trying to normalize this reality of closure in Sheikh Jarrah. And obviously the threat of forcible eviction and forcible displacement is still looming both in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah and in two main neighborhoods in the village of Silwan in the southeast of Jerusalem, which are Al Bustan neighborhood and Batn al Hawa neighborhood. So the same scenario that we're seeing in Sheikh Jarrah is threatening to repeat itself in Silwan. So all the root causes that inflame the situation continue to be there. The blockade, the Israeli occupations, the colonialism, the new things like the closure against Sheikh Jarrah, the daily abuse and intimidation of residents of Sheikh Jarrah and anyone who comes, or any Palestinian who comes to show solidarity or support for them. And obviously the mass threats of the home demolitions in Jerusalem and across the West Bank, and the suffocation of Palestinians in the territory, in the 48 territories, Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship. The mass arrests, every day there are mass arrests of Palestinians who participated in the last wave of resistance, in the most recent wave of resistance. So many of these arrests don't get covered because they are carried silently, but they are one of the tactics used by Israel to quell the current movement, to arrest as many people as possible, to deny them their most basic right when they are detained, to brutalize them during the period of interrogation, and to deny them any rights, even the right to contact their lawyers, to beat them during interrogation. All of these things continue to happen, and Israel continue to act unabated.
So in the context of this ongoing oppression, just to close out, I'd like to ask, is the character of these new uprisings different to those in the past, like it seems the media discourse is? What gives you reason for hope? And how would you suggest listeners can contribute or get involved with the cause of Palestinian liberation?
Yeah, I believe, as I said, I mean, sometimes we tend to think that whatever happens has never happened before. But then James Baldwin gives us this very important advice that you think that what you're happening to us, that you are alone, that you what's happening to us has never happened to anyone before, but then you read history, and this is what history teaches us, that things probably happened before to other people, and this makes you feel less lonely. I think for Palestinians in particular, yes, we've always, as I said, engaged in resistance, engaged in uprisings, and never really left and stopped resisting and stopped trying to stress our existence, to stress our resistance. What's different now, I think, is the really strong consciousness that's there, that we are fighting as a unified people wherever we exist, be it in Jerusalem, in Gaza, in the West Bank, in 48, in the diaspora, in exile. We're the sense that there is this unity that has, that Israel has long tried to break, has really been reborn during that last week, especially during the general strike that was declared and was very successful last week. And this gives me a reason for hope. Another thing that gives me a reason for hope, and this is why I think it's very rational hope, it's not just based on or on banal optimism, but rather on really seeing what's happening in the street, that what we're seeing today is an outcome of many small acts, of the accumulation of small acts of resistance, small lesser periods of resistance. What gives me reason of hope is to see that how this generation, new generation, is developing its new language, is not asking for anyone's permission to narrate its story, is reframing the discourse, is snatching its right to speak and not waiting for anyone to let it speak, is finding new ways to organize itself, is using social movements also on the ground to organize itself, feminist movements, youth movements, is learning, relearning its history in the process and recreating its own history also in the process. So this is for the next big moment that we will have. This is the infrastructure. We're creating an infrastructure of resistance, of popular resistance, upon which our everyday resistance will obviously be based, and all our uprising will be based. And I think we also managed to expose the fragility of the Israeli occupation, because when you are one of the most powerful armies in the world, and you're still so scared of young kids raising a flag, you're not powerful. You're just using your power to scare, to intimidate, but you don't really have the emotional authority, the moral authority. And you're so fragile that these bunch of young people can really scare the hell out of you. And this is what we've been seeing. And obviously once this movement gets more organized, because much of it has been spontaneous outburst of anger, I do have faith, hope that and confidence, trust, that the current movement will produce its own organizations, its own social movements, its own capacity to organize for something more less spontaneous and more sustainable. And again, as you said, many, I think I'm not going to add to what has already been said about the importance of social media in really allowing people to speak and not to have to rely on mainstream media, forcing mainstream media to come to us rather than us asking mainstream media to let us speak. So when you have these platforms, these spaces in social media, you are forcing people to listen to you and not begging people to listen to you.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
In solidarity.
Thank you. Okay, see you soon. Good luck.
If you're enjoying Rift, please consider contributing to our Patreon. Rift is entirely volunteer-run, and donations help us continue to create new content focusing on progressive politics and culture.